This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's review of all the important news from the last week. I'm Richard Palmer, and with me is our panel. Here in the Edstone studio, where I'm hosting today, we have Mikhailo Zekic.
Hello.
In our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Greetings.
And over at headquarters, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Rufaro Manyepa.
Hello.
Well, as you can probably tell already, we're missing quite a few people from our regular lineup as they're traveling over the Thanksgiving break. That's a holiday that is increasingly coming under attack, something that we'll talk about in the second half of the show. But we have an exciting lineup of subs, and it's always great to get some new perspectives and new voices on the week's news. I will start by hearing from one of those new voices. Over the last couple of months, one of the top news stories that we have been focusing on is Germany's next government. What is it going to look like? What's next for Germany? This story was the cover of our November-December Trumpet print magazine. And all of the news that we talk about, that we focus on this show, is completely driven by Bible prophecy, what the Bible tells us to watch for in world events. And this is why we're so focused on Germany's leadership. It plays an absolutely pivotal role in so many of these prophecies. And finally, we can give you some more answers and specifics about what Germany's next government looks like. Negotiations on that government are finished, meaning that we can get a good look at the plans for the years ahead for Germany. And here to tell us more is Mikhailo Zekic.
Yeah, so Germany just had their federal election in September on who would replace Angela Merkel. She wasn't running for re-election. And her Christian Democratic Union Party, the Conservatives in Germany, lost to the Social Democrats under Olaf Scholz. The Social Democrats up to this point have been in a coalition agreement with Merkel. Scholz was her deputy chancellor and finance minister. And he is poised now to become the newest chancellor of Germany. He just concluded election negotiations with the Free Democratic Party, which is a centrist, middle-of-the-road liberal party, and the Greens, which are, like any other green party, an environmentalist left-wing party. And the negotiations were pretty heated. They have quite they came out on Wednesday this week with their tentative agreement. It's 178 pages, and it has a lot of compromises on all sides. Not all the details have been made public yet, but looks like if all goes according to plan, they'll be able to form a new government early next month. This is an incredible achievement for Scholz. Merkel, last election in 2017, tried to create a coalition with the Free Democrats and the Greens, but failed to do so. And it was looking a little bit interesting on how Scholz would have been able to tackle this together. The Greens are very pro-environmentalist. Think of, like, you know, what in America we call the Green New Deal, bring in the net carbon neutrality, etc., while the Free Democrats are very pro-business, which in general usually means combating climate change and policies related to that. But Scholz seems to have put it together. And there are, again, a lot of juggling around between cabinet positions in order to get the Greens on board. Both the Free Democrats leader Christian Lindner and the co-leader of the Greens, Robert Habeck, wanted the finance ministry. A compromise was made. Lindner will get the finance ministry, while Habeck will get a new ministerial portfolio in charge of synchronizing Germany's economy with the climate, with climate neutrality. So in a sense, Germany will now have two finance ministries. The finance ministry is considered the most important job in the cabinet. So it's interesting to see how this plays out. Annalena Baerbock, the other Green co-leader, will become foreign minister, and the Social Democrats' cabinet positions have yet to be announced, but probably more of that will come in the coming days.
So we've both following this story pretty closely, both kind of very interested in what's going on in Germany. kind of deliberately haven't talked to you too much about this because I want to. I'm curious what your thoughts, what your take is on this coalition document. What do you think this tells us about Germany's next government?
Well, Germany is going to see a very, very strong veer to the left during the original campaign. Scholz, who again was Merkel's finance minister and deputy chancellor, he marketed himself as the true successor to Angela Merkel. His Social Democratic Party has been in coalition with her for a long time, and he's there's even common campaign posters of him showing or using Angela Merkel's traditional preacher's clasp to show how he's the continuation of her legacy. And so a lot of people voted with the expectation that things would remain the same under Angela Merkel. She's Germany's second longest serving chancellor. She's managed to lead Germany through some pretty big trials, such as there's a refugee crisis, the European debt crisis. Not perfectly, she's had her detractors, but in general, people have been able to commend her for her leading Germany through crises, battered but still standing. And some people were thinking that Scholz would have been able to do the same, but with the Greens on board, if you look at what the details of what this coalition agreement, what's inside the agreement, there's a lot of left-wing policies that would not have probably been otherwise made it into a coalition agreement with any other party. For example, they intend on legalizing cannabis, which would make Germany the first European country to do so. Other countries like Netherlands, technically, they've just decriminalized it. They want to bring a new focus on cultural issues. They want it easier for foreigners to become German and to even get dual citizenship. Migrants technically aren't mentioned here, but what's the elephant that's in the room is with all the migrants coming from Syria and other parts of the Middle East, some people are wondering if that means that there'll be a much quicker mass naturalization process. And there's also a huge chunk of the document is about on promoting queer life within Germany and LGBT issues. This is giving this is raising some people's eyebrows because the section on LGBT issues is nearly three times the size of the section on Jewish issues within Germany, even though there's been a recent increase in anti-Semitic attacks within Germany. Now, there's a lot of unknowns with this. The Bundesrat, which is the upper house of Germany's federal parliament, is still dominated by the Christian Democratic Union. And a lot of these things that the new German government we'll see if even these negotiations last. But a lot of the things they want to implement might be blocked by the upper parliament. So it remains to be seen exactly how some of these things will come to pass, but it's a pretty ambitious deal and one that in a sense almost betrays Scholz's campaigning as Merkel's successor. He's doing a lot of things that Angela Merkel didn't go anywhere near, but it'll be interesting to see how they try to attempt to pass these things through the German parliament.
Yeah, I agree. Good. Yeah, I mean, we've been reading the same articles, I guess, but that was exactly my takeaway as well, that it looks like Germany is going to be, or this government is either going to be far left or pretty useless, like you say, with the two foreign ministers and the chancellor there. And then, of course, there's all the massive green policies that they're implementing while Europe has some of the biggest energy prices, the highest energy prices in its history. This could be Germany shooting itself in the foot pretty badly. So why are we watching Germany? How does this, what is prophesied for Germany, and how could these events tie into that prophecy?
Well, one of the biggest trends that we at the Trumpet have been watching is the rise of a unified Europe under a strong man. We base this off of prophecies such as Revelation 17, Revelation 13, which talk about a beast, which prophetically means an empire. In this case, it's the Roman Empire. Revelation 17 specifically talks about resurrections of this empire after the original empire would fall. We've seen in history six of these resurrections come and go, the last of which culminated in Germany's role in World War II with Hitler and the Third Reich, which means there's one more to be raised on the scene. And other prophecies, you can combine it with other prophecies like Isaiah 10, which talk about the Assyrians being involved in this empire. The Assyrians are the ancient ancestors of today's Germans. And so we're watching for Germany to take a more assertive role in the world scene, to turn itself and Europe as a whole into a superpower. And we're also watching, you could tie it in with prophecies in Daniel 8, about a strong man to come and take control of that superpower. We don't expect Olaf Scholz to be that strong man per se. He's not exactly a very charismatic, dynamic leader. If he hadn't rode on Merkel's coattails, I don't think he would have been elected in the first place. But it is interesting to see some of these policies that he wants to put in. Like, for example, one of the agreements that they came out is to phase out coal by the 2030s in Germany and have a net positive renewable energy power Germany. And this, well, obviously, Germany is a very highly advanced industrial economy. A very small minority of the, well, not very small, but a small enough minority of their energy at this point is renewable. This would require a massive shift in German financing and in the German economy, and one that could, we've seen the effects of what a mass climate change combating policies can do in America, and how it can cause massive inflations of debt and so many people losing their jobs. And if this goes ahead in Germany, we could potentially see a similar trend there of the of lots of instability coming from this current German government, lots of economic problems caused by the left-wing policies. And that's going to, Germans are already pretty dissatisfied with their political system as it is. This last election was, and 2017 before it, are among the most polarizing of political parties for Germany since World War II, with different splinter parties and extremist parties coming out of nowhere, basically. And if this government decides to go down the same track that the administration in Washington is, that's going to cause a lot more problems for Germany, and a lot more people are going to become dissatisfied with the current government and want change. Want real change in their government, want something, somebody that can take a more strong arm approach to fix all these problems that have been festering for years and bring Germany back to what it sees as one of the main power sources in Europe. But in order to do that, it's going to involve people turning away from the left leaning politicians towards someone more conservative, more perhaps more traditionalist, more tied with the religious establishment per se, but also somebody that's not afraid to circumvent constitutional democratic ideals to get his way done, to fix problems. And that's going to create a perfect storm that that allows this strong man, when he does come, to take control of Germany, the most powerful country in Europe and the European as a whole, and take it on a much more dynamic and powerful direction than it is now.
So Olaf Scholz may well be the weak man that paves the way for the strong man that we've been looking for. Well, we do have a free booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, that spells out in detail exactly why we're watching for this leader in Europe, the role that he is going to play in the world, and why all of these prophecies in the Bible apply to him. And we could see with this German government paving the way for just a rising appetite for that strong man. Well, our next story is one that the left would rather you forget. On Sunday, Daryl Brooks drove his SUV through a parade in Waukesha, Wisconsin, killing at least six and injuring dozens. It was a dramatic attack. I think it shook people around the world. It made plenty of headlines here, even in the UK, but it very quickly dropped out of the mainstream media, with many, especially in the US, remarkably uncurious about this attacker and his motives. So here to tell us more about this story, we have Andrew Miller.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The attack itself was just horrendous. There's five grandmothers killed, one grandfather killed, almost 50 people injured, including about a dozen children. But just as horrendous is why the attack happened and how the media has responded to it. This Daryl Brooks, he's actually been arrested for felonies 16 times in the past 20 years. Felonies including drug possession, sex offenses, strangulation, suffocation, illegal firearms possession, resisting arrest, assault and battery, and trying to run over his girlfriend with a car. The New Americans also reported that he was both a black supremacist and a member of the 5% Nation, which is a radical Islamic group here in the United States. So this man is a black supremacist, radical Islamic terrorist with a long career rap sheet of crimes, who was arrested just like 2 weeks ago for trying to run over the mother of his child with a vehicle, and yet was released on only $1,000 bail. That's when the shortly after when the incident happened that killed all the people, is that he got involved in yet another domestic dispute, assaulted somebody after getting out of jail, and then drove away from the scene and ran into this crowd. And so that's one thing that a lot of people should be asking is the Democrats right now in the United States are pushing in many cities to get bail reduced. And just like, well, why are they so worried about getting bail reduced when things like this are happening? And that's an important discussion people should be having. Also explains a little bit as to why the Democrats don't want to focus on this story. It definitely hurts their case that we need reduced bail in America. It also hurts their case, as CNN recently said in the wake of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, that the most dangerous thing in America is an angry white man, because now here we have an angry black Islamic terrorist who's killed five people, injured almost 50, when he shouldn't have been on the streets at all. And you'll barely hear any of this. I think CNN, the Babylon Bee, was making fun of them this week, because CNN reported on this story as a deadly car accident. And the Babylon Bee made the point, so said, yeah, it's like technically accurate, but it makes about as much sense as reporting on Pearl Harbor as a deadly boat accident.
Yeah, it is. It has been remarkable to see the contrast with some of the other attacks. And like you say, it is a very disturbing part of this story. There are very reasonable things that you could do to stop this from happening again. So again, with the Bible prophecy focus, you know, how does this story tie in with some of those trends that we're watching?
Well, I think the resource we can put in the show notes is America Under Attack by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, that really covers, there's a spiritual dimension, an evil spiritual dimension trying to tear down the United States. And you really have to understand that to make sense of something like this, because just a common sense leader wouldn't even have to be tremendously religious. If you were looking at something like this and trying to figure out, like, how are we going to stop this from going in the future, it's like, well, maybe we should be paying more attention to black supremacist and Islamic terrorists and the threat they pose to America, for one. And for two, maybe we should look at our bail laws and make sure that we're not letting people who are who tried to run their girlfriend over a week ago run into a crowd of people on only $1,000 bail. But that's not the reaction you're getting at all. They're doing everything they can to cover up this man's radical past. And it was only, I think, a day, 2 days after the attack that some public officials in New York City renewed their call to lower bails. And so it really makes you think that it's almost like they're trying to have things like this happening. They say, it's like, if we can lower the bails and empty the prisons and get enough people on the streets to create chaos, we can really just tear down this nation and then use the media to make it look like the big threat in America is like racist in American justice system, which it really looks like the only really systematic racist is in the, at least in the Waukesha justice system, is in favor of the black Islamic supremacist, because we had every warning sign for the past 16 years that this man should be in jail, and decided to deliberately put him on the streets anyway.
And if you've not read that book, America Under Attack, I would really add my encouragement to go and read that. I think it is just hard to make so many of the decisions that are coming out of Washington and the radical left are really hard to make any kind of logical sense of. And that book just makes sense of them. It adds that, it explains why you see people making these crazy decisions that are so destructive to the United States, and in this case, harm so many people. So you can get that book on our website, thetrumpet.com. All of the material, all of those different books that we mention, we'll put on our website, and we will have links to those in the notes for the show so that you can go and track down those books. And it is all free. We ship them free anywhere in the world, and we would really encourage you to go and read that. But that America Under Attack really does, it's just crucial for understanding American news. Moving on to another important story that you won't have seen much about in the U.S. media. Japan is smashing all records with its military budget. Here to tell us more and explain why you should be concerned is Rufaro Manyepa.
Yeah, Japan is definitely very active. This is from today, actually. Its cabinet today approved adding $6.7 billion to its defense budget. Now, this is really important because Japan had actually added more to its fiscal year budget earlier this year. And then this addition right here, it's another record addition to its defense budget again this year. And this is the seventh straight year that Japan has had a record-breaking defense budget increase. And the fact that it's done this just the second time in the same year shows just how serious Japan is. It's talking about threats from China and North Korea as the reason for its radical increase in its defense spending. But when you look at the figures, Japan is really going all out in its additions. It's supposed to have a cap of 1% of its GDP for its military defense spending. This budget increase that's been approved today is going to take that to 1.3% of its GDP. Now, figures like that might not look very big, but then when you consider the fact that Japan is I think the third most powerful economy in the world, right? The fact that it's adding 0.3% of its GDP to its military defending, that's huge, right? Because as it stands, it's about ninth place in military expenditure in the world. But then in addition like this, it's going to take it third, just behind the United States and China. This is a serious addition. And what it's targeting right now is bolstering its air and missile defense systems, buying more cruise missiles, buying more anti-ship missiles, really increasing its naval power, because that's where Japan's strength is. And so this is something that Japan's Prime Minister Kishida Fumio had pledged to do. He actually wants to take Japan's defense spending up to 2% of its GDP. So this right here, the fact that it's happening so quickly, and it's only been a couple of months that this prime minister has been in office, it's showing just how anxious Japan is to increase its defense spending. Now, Japan for decades has been a pacifist nation, right? It had pledged that it would keep its military spending to within 1% of its GDP. It had pledged that it wouldn't involve in any actions of self-defense at all, both at home and overseas, just because of what it had done in World War II. But the pressure that Japan is getting from China, as it feels, around Taiwan, and it feels also that Beijing's control of that would bring China to within 100 kilometers of Japan. This is making it very anxious, making it very jittery, because not only because of the security threat, but even the fact that those are maritime trade routes that Japan depends on for things like oil all across the Western Pacific. So Japan is acting, and this is something that is reminiscent of what happened a few decades ago leading into World War II. And a lot of people aren't watching this steady increase of defense spending, but it's something really concerning, how Japan is just continually increasing its defense spending.
Yeah, that really is remarkable. I didn't realize that put them in third place, which would make them spending more, which would see them spending more on their military each year than Russia does. And you look at how Russia can kind of make the world tremble. that's quite a remarkable level of spending, especially for a pacifist country that military is outlawed, and now they're getting all of these defensive-only cruise missiles and aircraft carriers, weapons that really don't lend themselves well to defensive-only types of military operations. So this was something that Herbert W. Armstrong specifically forecast decades ago because this is something that the Bible talks about. Can you tell us more about those prophecies?
Right. Yeah. In 1971, actually, when Japan was still solidly pacifist, when it had come out of World War II with that new constitution that was really serious about saying that they can't engage in military activity, Mr. Armstrong, he said Japan today has no military establishment, but we should not lose sight of the fact that that Japan has become so powerful economically that it could build a military force of very great power very rapidly. That's an incredibly prescient statement that he made then, because you look at it today, as Japan has got such a powerful military, and just like that one cabinet vote, and they can have defense spending that just catapults them ahead of almost every other country in the world. And you look at Japan's history, and it shows why this is something that should be really concerning: a militarily strong Japan. In the massacre of Nanjing, for example, Japanese troops murdered over 200,000 Chinese civilians. We're talking men, women, children, just complete horror show. And these weren't just soldiers doing their own thing. This was with the stamp of approval of Japanese leaders at the time. Right, and you fast forward to World War II, and it was only after 14 years of war, 3 million deaths, that only two atomic bombs stopped Japanese fanaticism in the war. Right, this is serious when we're talking about what it means for Japan to be militarizing. Right, and Mr. Armstrong, when he made that prediction in 1971, he was looking at prophecies in Revelation 16. You know, verse 12 talks about the kings of the East, right? This massive military power that's going to be comprised of Asian nations, right? And you look at Ezekiel 38, verse 6, it goes specifically into the identity of these nations that are going to make up the kings of the East. And it talks about Goma and Togarma as members of this alliance. And these are just ancient names for Japan. And this military behemoth, it's going to be a part of just a devastating time on the earth. It's going to be responsible for lots of deaths, for a lot of destruction. And the fact that Japan is militarizing the way that it is, how we see it building towards that, you know, we're not really sure how it's going to finally lodge itself into this alliance, but this buildup right here is definitely indicative of what's coming and what the Bible's prophesying and what Mr. Armstrong said all those years ago.
Thank you for that, Rafaro. That's just another dramatic example of one of Mr. Armstrong's forecasts being proven true, because really they weren't his forecasts. They were based on Bible prophecy. And you can read more about what he said and how this prophecy has been so clearly fulfilled in our trends article, Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Towards Militarism. Another country that's rapidly advancing its military is Iran, but its focus is on developing nuclear weapons. Talks are due to start with Iran on its nuclear program on Monday. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry called President Obama's nuclear deal the worst foreign policy blunder in American history. To learn more about the latest version of these type of discussions, we'll hear from our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, there's a slew of articles that came out just really preempting the talks that are going to take place on Monday, will start taking place on Monday, renewed nuclear negotiations that's trying to put Iran back in the box, or at least halt, it seems, their march towards a nuclear weapon. I don't think people are aware just how much Iran has continued on to developing a nuclear weapon over the past few years. And there was an article this week, just from 2 days ago, in Time magazine, which had a pretty lengthy interview with General Kenneth McKenzie. He's the commander of U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM. So he's in charge of the Middle East military for the United States. And this is somebody that oversaw a lot of the horrible evacuation from Afghanistan. However, he said some really interesting things in this interview. And I'll just quote, I won't quote from him just yet, just from the timepiece, though, that he's quoted in. It said this: Iran is now further along in its nuclear weapons program than ever. So that's how far away they are, along they are, producing stocks of uranium enriched to 60% purity, edging closer towards 90% weapon grade. And then it quotes a recent study from the Institute of Science and International Security. This is the premier organization, private organization that looks into the Iran nuclear program. I forget the lead, the person that runs this, the good ISIS they call themselves, used to be a weapons inspector for the IAEA back in the day. They said in September that Iran could produce enough fissile material in a month's time. So they've got 1 month right now before they reach enough fissile material to have a nuclear weapon. So that's how close we are at the very beginning of these talks. We talked about last week how that the United States has probably already moved the goalposts, how they are looking into reducing sanctions, giving Iran access to money for just freezing it where they are right now, which is really not even going back to what it was in the 2015. So that would be a horrible deal. A couple of quotes from this article are really interesting, because McKenzie is basically saying, one, he says our president said they're not going to have a nuclear weapon. Then he talks about how even though they might be 1 month away from nuclear breakout, the article says this: even if Tehran decides to amass enough fuel for a bomb, McKenzie says, the nation hasn't yet standardized a design for a warhead that's small enough to be fixed atop any of its arsenal of 3,000 ballistic missiles, nor has Iran shown that it can build a reentry vehicle capable of surviving and the searing heat, pressure, and vibration of falling back from space to Earth. Quote, we haven't seen any of that. This is McKenzie again. That's what's going to take a little time for them to build. He estimates it will take Iran more than a year to develop this capability with a robust testing program. So what you see in this is that it looks like McKenzie and the United States' position right now is they are going to start moving away from Iran doesn't have enough nuclear weapon for a nuclear bomb to Iran doesn't have the delivery system for a nuclear weapon. And this is a really critical change, because up to this point, it's been Iran doesn't have enough for a bomb. How far is Iran close to a bomb having enough nuclear material for a bomb? And it seems like the United States is actually kind of showing their cards here, that they are going to accept an Iran with enough nuclear material, but they don't have a delivery system for it yet. So they're still a year away from the bomb right now. So we don't have to worry about things too much.
So I guess with this shifting goalpost, would it still be the case, though, that Hezbollah could be a delivery system? Like, if they have enough fissile material, would they be able to build a bomb that they could attack using some other means other than missiles?
Yeah, and that's why it's very dangerous logic here. That's why the critical thing was, can they produce a nuclear bomb, like a suitcase bomb? You don't actually have to put it on a ballistic missile. You can take it there, and Hezbollah can deliver it. Sure, I think Israeli intelligence would be onto that. Or even the question becomes, you know, the best buds of the Iranian nuclear program with the North Koreans. They shared information. Iranian scientists are there present at North Korean weapons tests, ballistic missile tests for nuclear weapons. And so to just say that Iran is still a year away from a nuclear weapon because they don't have the delivery system yet is a real danger, I think, for people to accept. And they shouldn't accept it. The reality is Iran is a month away from having enough material for a nuclear bomb, 3 months away from having enough nuclear material for two, and 5 months away from having enough nuclear material for three. That's a scary thought. People are so tired of hearing about nuclear negotiations and so tired of hearing about Iran. And so I just wonder if people have been lulled to sleep hearing about this for so long. Yet again, even as McKenzie said, Iran is closer to a bomb right now than they have ever been before.
And on that subject, of people being lulled to sleep. I mean, a lot of countries have nuclear bombs now. You mentioned North Korea, India, Pakistan. There are a lot of quite a few nuclear bombs out there. Why is it so concerning for Iran to have a nuclear weapon?
Right. And you would have to accept this to part of the rationale behind how Obama and now Biden are selling this nuclear deal is that they believe and they've said that Iran is a rational actor, that they carrot and sticks approach to apply to Iran, that mutually assured destruction as it applied to everybody else with nuclear weapons also applies to the Iranians. However, everyone that studied Iran, everyone that's just looked at Iran over the past 40 years know that they are hell-bent on destruction. They don't mind if their own country burns in a nuclear conflagration. They're actually fine with that. As according to their Shiite 12-erism theology, again, all they need to produce is global chaos, enough chaos that will motivate the return of their messiah figure. And so they don't have to win the war, they just have to have enough to start it. And so that's why a nuclear weapon is dangerous in Iran's hands, because they, as opposed to everybody else, it seems, wouldn't be afraid of retaliatory strikes on their home country if they can start that war.
And so, of course, we use Bible prophecy is the main reason we're most concerned about this. How does this story tie in with Bible prophecy?
Well, I think a couple of points. One is that we know that this current American administration has had a really just a seismic shift in their foreign policy ideals for the Middle East, and that is to champion Israel's enemies and give them the money and now give cover to them getting the firepower to wreak havoc on the nation of little nation of Israel, biblical Judah. That is something that Mr. Flurry has written about for some time as well. I think the main prophetic element, though, is the fact that in Daniel 11, verse 40, the king of the south that's mentioned there, that really is the aggressor pushing the world towards war, and that makes the really World War III start. It's this really aggressive actor in the Middle East that is an Iranian-led kingdom. An Iranian-led group of nations is an alliance that has enough power to motivate an overwhelming blitzkrieg response from Europe. Why do that? Why was Europe going to respond so forcefully, as that prophecy says in Daniel 11, verse 40? Maybe they fear that Iran will use a nuclear weapon on them. It shows that Iran actually has something to hurt Europe. Perhaps that's control, or will be control over certain trade routes, but perhaps also the fact that they might have a nuclear weapon as well that they intend to use. This is all explained, that's explained in Gerald Flory's book, The King of the South. But I think if people are really thinking that we're not in nuclear times or a time when nuclear weapons could be used, I think an even better booklet for people to read is A Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door.
Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. And we'll link to both The King of the South and Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door in our show notes. Well, coming up in the second half, we're going to talk about the prospect of nuclear weapons in Poland this time and discuss the left's attack on Thanksgiving. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Well, just before the break, we were talking about Iran's nuclear program. Well, there's also talk of nuclear weapons popping up in Poland. This would be, if not a world-shaking development, certainly a Europe and Russia-shaking one. Here to tell us more, we'll hear from Mykhailo Zekic.
Yeah, sure. On last Friday, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg gave a speech in Berlin. He's obviously represents the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, so he has some oversight over the alliance between America and various European powers. And lately in Germany, as we were talking about with the coalition talks, a prominent social democrat recently said that Germany should get rid of its NATO nuclear weapons sharings missiles from its territory. Now, NATO operates a nuclear sharing program where American nuclear missiles will be stationed in various countries in Europe, like Germany, Italy, Belgium. This was basically mainly meant to deflect threats from the Soviet Union. It's been a long time since the Soviet Union was around, and some in Germany are saying that they should go. And Stoltenberg, he did two interesting things with this speech. A first thing, he reinforced that Germany should keep the nuclear weapons on its soil. He says, and I quote, "And I count on Germany to remain committed to NATO's nuclear sharing. It is our ultimate security guarantee," end quote. And Stoltenberg, he's a former prime minister of Norway. Norway shares a small border with Russia. He probably looks at this a little bit differently than maybe some other countries do. And the other thing is that he said later on in the speech, quote, "The nuclear weapons we share in NATO provide European allies with an effective nuclear umbrella. This, of course, also includes our Eastern allies," end quote. Now, there's a lot of Eastern European countries formerly allied with the Soviet Union, like Poland, like the Baltic states, that are now very solid members of NATO. And it was a bit ambiguous what Stoltenberg meant by that. People in Russia are taking it to mean that perhaps nuclear weapons, if they leave Germany, could end up being stationed in countries like Poland. A lot of Russian state-sponsored news organizations like RT News or Sputnik are making those claims. Their opinions and editorials are a bit dubious at best on how relevant they are. So perhaps we should take their views with a grain of salt. But at the same time, it's interesting that, A, you have the Secretary General of NATO arguing that nuclear weapons need to stay in Germany. The whole point that NATO was created in the first place, as its first Secretary General, Lord Hastings Ismay, said, is to keep the Americans in, the Russians out, and the Germans down. Not only now is Germany being exalted as a member to the ultimate security guarantee in European NATO, but they're saying that, no, Germany, you don't want your nukes. We need you to have your nukes. Please keep your nukes. And the other hand, you have countries like Poland who are even more terrified of a Russian invasion. It's a little bit ambiguous as to whether they'd accept nuclear weapons or not. Poland has not signed or ratified the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. And a little while back, a former NATO ambassador from Poland even contemplated the idea of having Polish or NATO nukes stationed in Poland. And Poland is a bit of a more conservative country. They see the Russian threat a lot more vividly than some other countries do. So if there was an offer made for them to have nuclear weapons, there's a decent chance, compared to some other countries, they might actually accept it. So whereas at once the Cold War collapsed, some people were talking about this being the end of history, that war's over, that the mutually assured destruction and all these other Cold War ideas are over, we're seeing again the reinforcement of these ideas and importance of countries in NATO and having nuclear weapons against a nuclear armed Russia.
And this is something, this trend of rising in nuclear weapons, is something Brent touched on, pointing to that free booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, a great place to go to learn more about this rise in nuclear weapons. But just very quickly, you also had something in mind, a prophetic tie-in for what's happening in Europe specifically.
Well, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, wrote an article a few years back called Europe's Nuclear Secret, which talks about NATO nuclear sharing and stationing countries like Germany and Italy, and the danger that some of these countries that we expect to be part of the Revelation 17 beast holding American nuclear weapons and potentially sending them back to the United States. It's a really good resource to learn more about this subject.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. We will link to that article, Europe's Nuclear Secrets, in the show notes. The Bible has some very specific prophecies about the country of Syria. Based on those prophecies, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury wrote an article titled How the Syrian Crisis Will End, all the way back in 2012, making some very specific forecasts about this country. Well, that Syrian crisis is still ongoing, but we saw an important step towards that prophesied destination this week. Here to tell us more is Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, we have been tracking what's happened in Syria for about a decade now, or almost a decade. And the big prophecy we're looking for is Iran to be booted or leave Syria and this alliance between Syria and Iran, whether it's Assad or the current president of Syria breaking from Iran, or perhaps different leadership arising in Syria that doesn't like Iran. We didn't know necessarily how it's going to happen, but we know that based on a prophecy found in Psalm chapter 83, one that's yet to take place, that Syria is mentioned in that prophecy, and this is an alliance that is inherently an anti-Iranian alliance. And so we have expected a divorce between Iran and Syria and been watching for that. And what we saw this week is just a really interesting facet of this and how it might come about, and that is that this was reported in a Saudi paper based in London. It says Russia and Iran understanding leads to T4 airbase evacuation in Syria. So this is a base, T4, you might have heard about this. This is where Iran launches a lot of its drones against the Israelis, launches a lot of its missiles against the Israelis. This was a very strategic location for them, airbase right in the middle of the country. And Russia has succeeded in removing the Iranians from that base. And this is really significant because it's not something that Iran would like to give up. Of course, the Russians are in an alliance with the Iranians and have done for so long. But as we've been riding on for perhaps the past 5 years, ever since Russia got involved in Syria, is that fundamentally these two powers can't stay there together. One of them's going to have to go. And Russia, over the past 3 or 4 years, has become increasingly closer to the Syrian regime and is worried that unless the Iranians leave, there's going to be no peaceful settlement inside Syria. And while Russia doesn't necessarily care about peace, they care about getting paid. And the only way that they get paid is if they get awarded reconstruction contract rights inside Syria, which the Syrian government has promised them. But Syria is not going to have any money to do that until the Iranians go, because their nation has been hijacked by the Iranians. And so Russia has basically said to Iran, you need to leave T4 and leave it now, because the Israelis keep on attacking you. We're never going to get any type of stable situation unless you start leaving these critical bases. And we got the first sign that Iran wheels up and left with a lot of their heavy equipment just this past week.
And so obviously we set up this talking about why we're zoomed in on Syria because of some of these specific prophecies. Can you go over some of those for us?
Yeah, well, this prophecy, as I mentioned before, is found in Psalm 83. It's got an alliance there that talks about the Hagarenes, which are a people that occupied anciently the western part of Syria and where Damascus is in this region. And we've talked about how the Hagarenes, again, are going to align with Lebanon, the Saudis, the Ishmaelites, the Jordanians, and they're going to be in alliance with Europe in the end. Assyria is mentioned inside that prophecy as well, biblical Germany, or Germany in the modern times. And so we expect a pretty big shift in alliances between the two, away from Iran and in favor of a German-led Europe. And Syria, again, is going to side with the other moderate Arabs as well in that.
And we do have more on that alliance in the book, same book we mentioned earlier, The King of the South. Well, we talked in the first half about Japan militarizing, but China is also driving forwards at a rapid pace, especially in overseas expansion and really increasing their military technology. Here to tell us more is Rufaro Manyipa.
Yeah, new satellite imagery from the Center for Strategic and International Studies shows that China is about to complete construction on a brand new aircraft carrier. It's expected to be launched as early as February next year, as a matter of fact. And this new carrier, it's the third one that China will have, but it's by far the most advanced. In fact, it's considered to be on par with the type of aircraft carriers that the United States produces. And when you look at what experts are saying about this, there's one who said that this aircraft carrier shows that China is pushing the boundaries of what they can do. That's just how advanced the technology on this aircraft carrier is. And when taking that into account with everything else, China's got the world's largest navy, as a matter of fact. It's got really advanced stealth fighter jets. It's got a rapidly increasing and growing arsenal of nuclear weapons. Its military modernization is really startling at this moment. Its budget is continuously growing. It's likely going to surpass $200 billion this year. And while that's still a long way behind the United States, the technological gap of the weapons that China is developing with that budget is putting it really close to the United States. Now, what's really significant about all this is that it's creating a bit of a security dilemma in Asia, right? What's happening is that China is building up its military so quickly, so rapidly. And then other Asian nations are seeing this and saying, well, we have to build up as well, because what if China comes after us? You think of India, for example. It's been rapidly increasing its military in response because it's been seeing what China's been doing. And it's had that dispute across the border with China for a while now. And so it's also starting to increase its military growth. Just last week, the delivery of the S-400 missile defense system to India from Russia started, right? And they're getting that and they're growing. They're making sure that they have the weapons that they need in a possible confrontation with Pakistan, which China happens to be supplying with stealth technology as well right now. And then you throw in Japan into the mix, as we were talking about earlier, and the fact that Japan is seeing all of this happen. It's seeing that China, of all people, has got the world's largest navy, when Japan prides itself as being a naval force. It, too, is upping the ante and increasing its defense spending. And all across Asia, you see these different groupings and different alliances and different partnerships coming together. And they're all pushing each other in this security dilemma to grow their militaries. And I even find it funny that even South Korea tested a missile just last month. And then North Korea came out and scolded South Korea for displaying reckless ambition in doing something like that.
And of course, this push to militarization, it ties right in with those same prophecies that you were talking about when we were back talking about Japan.
Exactly. Because even though it looks like they're pushing each other militarily in different directions, the prophecies show that all these countries that are developing powerfully right now are ultimately going to come together as the kings of the East. And if you look at our booklet, the Russia and China in Prophecy, it points to all of this coming together in a really remarkable way. And this military power is going to be incredibly powerful when that time comes.
And we'll point to that booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, in the show notes. Thank you for that, Rufaro. And finally, we have just had Thanksgiving, one of the most profound national holidays anywhere in the world. It's not one we typically keep in the UK, but one I certainly grew to appreciate while living in the US. Not only does it encourage gratitude, but there's so much of that day that points Americans back to their history with God. And so it's no surprise that this day is coming under sustained attack. Here to tell us more, we'll hear finally from Andrew Miller.
Yeah, we had a little bit of a bright spot, a little bit of good news this week, and the Wall Street Journal has really stood up against some pretty intense pressure from the radical left and agreed to keep publishing its Thanksgiving editorials. Now, since 1961, the Wall Street Journal has published two editorials from a former editor of theirs, one titled The Desolate Wilderness and one titled The Fair Land, that really focus in on the history of the pilgrims and the blessings America can be grateful for. They're both pretty touching editorials that many Americans read every year at Thanksgiving. But there's a sentence in The Desolate Wilderness that says that when the pilgrims arrived in America, it was a desolate land full of wild beasts and wild men. And that's really gotten change.org, super PAC with deep connections to Barack Obama, to get a petition to try to get these articles out of circulation because of their insults to the Native Americans. That really being the only thing that could even be misconstrued as an insult is the sentence about wild men in the editorial. But it does just really show how intense just the pressure against this holiday is mounting. The Wall Street Journal is one of the better ones, but most new media outlets now are trying to paint Thanksgiving as a celebration of genocide and a celebration of white supremacy, which really anyone who read these two articles that the left's trying to get take down would realize is not true. If you were really concerned about the Native Americans, there's plenty of problems on Indian reservations today you could talk about. There's even a number of historical incidents of Indians being mistreated you could talk about, but the relationship between the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag was really one of the bright spots in the relationship between the colonists and the Native Americans that you could talk about. And the fact that the radical left is coming after the Pilgrims of all the different settlers you could talk about does really show that it's not out of a concern for Native Americans, but really a hatred of the biblical values the Pilgrims believed in, which ties right back into what we were talking about in the first half of the show about America under attack, where there's just this effort to cover up a black supremacist and Islamic terrorist from media scrutiny, while at the same time trying to hold the Pilgrims up as the example of everything that's wrong with the United States of America.
And we do have a couple of great articles on Thanksgiving as well on our website, which we'll link to in the show notes. I'm Richard Palmer, and that's all we have time for here on Trumpet Hour. You can email the show at letters@thetrumpet.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Thanks to our panel, Brent Nachtigall, Andrew Miller, Rufaro Manyepa, and Michalo Zekic. Thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of George Orwell. In times of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour, and until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.